That lines Iran's leader calls for a lasting ceasefire in Yemen and advises Saudi rulers not to continue a war that they are not going to win. Russia's Putin says the most important conclusion from the Ukraine war is that the unipolar world order built by the United States is falling apart. And also, renewed violence in the West Bank. Israeli forces gunned down a Palestinian and injured dozens more during a raid in Nablus. Top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Saudi Arabia does not have a chance of winning its war on Yemen, urging the kingdom to stop its aggression there. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, with the efforts of the Yemeni people and the courage of their leaders, a Saudi victory is impossible. He called on Saudi officials to find a way out of this war. Iran's leader expressed support for negotiations and a lasting ceasefire in Yemen and praised the patience of the people of that country. Yemen has been devastated by war waged by Saudi Arabia and some of its Arab allies in March 2015. According to the UN, more than 300,000 Yemenis have been killed through direct or indirect causes such as hunger. We've reached out to political commentator Mohsen Saleh to get his thoughts on the Saudi aggression against Yemen. He says Riyadh needs to urgently look for ways to have a peaceful coexistence with its neighbor.
The Saudis, they committed crimes. They paid a lot of money in order to let the Yemenis bow for them, which is, I think, they failed. They failed drastically. They damn failed. And now the Saudis, they have one choice only. They don't have another choice. Yesterday or 1 week ago, they have appointed some of the people of the Yemenis and brought them to Riyadh in order to find a solution. And they send them a message to the Ansarullah to come and join. They can't join Riyadh. Riyadh, you are one of the parties who aggressed, who killed the Yemenis. You have to go to another place and say, well, we have failed, and we come to terms in order to find an understanding with the Yemenis and live a peaceful life neighbor to neighbor. That's the natural thing. And I guess the Saudis now, they have to receive the consequences of their aggression against the Yemenis. And I guess it's not going to be easy. It will really make the Saudis that regret their aggression against Yemen.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, renews revenge calls for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and anti-terror figure Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Commander of the IRGC Ground Force, Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpour, says Iran has taken a series of powerful and devastating retaliatory measures against the U.S. and Israel. He said those measures are in addition to Iranian missile attacks that hit a U.S. airbase in Iraq on January the 8th, 2020, 5 days after Soleimani was killed. Pakpour added that even if all American leaders are killed, it will not be enough to avenge General Soleimani's death. The IRGC commander also hailed Iran's deterrence capabilities, saying the country is ready to repel foreign threats. He stressed that Iran's enemies no longer have the strength to take any action against the Islamic Republic. Hundreds of Afghans have gathered outside the Iranian embassy in the capital, Kabul, condemning the recent attacks on Iran's diplomatic missions in their country. The Afghan protesters chanted slogans in support of unity between the two countries and denounced enemy seditions to divide them. A similar gathering is planned outside the Iranian consulate general in Herat on Monday. The consulate there, as well as the Iranian embassy in Kabul, were attacked by extremist mobs throwing stones at the buildings. That happened amid protests over alleged mistreatment of Afghan refugees in Iran. On Tuesday, Iran summoned the Afghan charge d'affaires to lodge a strong protest over the attacks. Iran has blamed the attacks on ill-wishers trying to harm the strong bonds between the two neighbors. Well, the unipolar international order the U.S. has built after the Cold War is breaking up. That's according to the Russian president. Vladimir Putin believes the end of such order is the most important strategic conclusion from Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The Russian president made the comment at a meeting with his Belarusian counterpart on Tuesday. Putin said Russia will calmly continue its Ukraine operation until all goals are achieved. He called the situation in Ukraine a tragedy, but said Moscow had no other choice. Putin said Russia has to fight to prevent Ukraine from becoming a springboard for Moscow's enemies. He also called the anti-Russia sanctions imposed by the West as an economic blitzkrieg that has failed. The United States is preparing to announce a new military aid package for Ukraine in its war with Russia, now in its 49th day. Reuters, citing American officials, says the package could be worth $750 million and will be announced as early as this week. It includes new capabilities such as unmanned surface vehicles and helicopters. The military aid is believed to be specifically aimed at helping Ukraine fight Russia in the eastern Donbass region. Ukraine and its Western allies believe that Russia is preparing to take Donbass. The region includes the pro-Russian self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk. Last week, the White House said it has provided over $1.7 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Italy's economy, already tested by 2 years of anti-pandemic measures, is further suffering from sanctions imposed on Moscow by the members of the European Union following the war in Ukraine. Inflation in Italy continues to grow as authorities fear serious repercussions on the country's society. Max Hughey reports from Rome.
1.5 months into the Ukraine war, and the effects of the conflict are starting to bite hard into Italy's economy. 2 years of anti-COVID measures and a series of sanctions adopted against Russia, the largest and most severe restrictive penalties ever adopted by the European Union, have piled pressure on Italy, which is among the countries relying the most on raw materials from Moscow. Russia's natural gas accounts for about 40% of Italy's total gas supply. Due to soaring energy prices, Italy's inflation surged to 7% in March, the highest rate ever recorded in 3 decades.
L'inflazione è preoccupante.
The current inflation rate in Italy is worrying, as it can seriously affect families. At this stage, it's impossible to make any prediction. However, if things remain this way, the country may well slip into recession in the coming future. It's the globalization itself that has been greatly put to the test by the 2008 financial crisis, the pandemic, and now the Ukraine war.
The Bank of Italy has recently warned that the country's annual inflation rate would rise to over 8% this year if the Mario Draghi government opts to enact a complete halt in gas supplies to Italy from Russia. Meanwhile, Rome has slashed its growth estimate for this year, forecasting the country's gross domestic product to grow by 3.1%, down from a 4.7% projection made last September. During a ceremony for the 170th anniversary of the state police force, the Italian Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese warned that the nefarious effects of the war in Ukraine risk creating major social problems in Italy. Problems, the minister noted, that must be urgently addressed.
The situation of uncertainty on the economic and social front that the war opened, in part due to the effect on the energy market and the supply of raw materials, could have a major impact on industrial production, economic growth, employment levels, and therefore on the country's social moorings.
Thousands of small and medium firms have already been forced to shut down or reduce their activities across the country. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli forces have killed one more Palestinian amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a man 34 years old was shot dead in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli forces conducted a raid there, also injuring 31 people. The latest death brings to 6 the number of Palestinians killed in Israeli crackdown across the West Bank since Sunday. Mass arrests have also been made, including 14 on Tuesday. The regime launched its crackdown following a series of deadly attacks by Palestinians in Israel in the past 3 weeks. Those attacks left 14 Israelis dead. Israeli forces killed 16 Palestinians during the same period. Palestinians say the attacks are in response to Israeli crimes. Palestinian journalist and columnist for Palestine Pulse at Al Monitor joins us now from Amman, Mr. Dawood Kotab. Mr. Kotab, welcome to the program. There's been a rise in Palestinian reprisal attacks against Israeli forces recently. Can you tell us more about why that is happening? And is this, in your opinion, a prelude to maybe a third Palestinian intifada?
Well, things have been very tense, especially in April, because the situation in Jerusalem has not died down. The rhetoric by the extremists and even by the government and the refusal to keep Al-Aqsa Mosque clean from the invading settlers and extremists has basically raise the tensions, and also the question of Jenin. The Israelis are trying to destroy or to put the Jenin camp under extreme siege has caused basically an escalation of the violence. But all in all, the big reason for all of this is that there is no hope for Palestinians. Horizon for political affairs, for the political horizon, is totally shut, and Palestinians are desperate. They don't see any effort, any solution process that is going on, and so people are helpless and frustrated, carry out acts of revenge and attacks, and the cycle of violence continues.
Mr. Kotab, Israel, the crimes that it commits on a daily basis against the Palestinians, it seizes their land, demolishes their homes, burns their olive groves, kills and jails them, arrests children. Still, Israelis seem to be shocked at the Palestinian reaction. Is it inevitable that the Palestinians living under brutalized occupation will react one way or another?
The problem. We've been, more than half a century under occupation. Israelis are living their lives, enjoying their lives, enjoying an economy, and they don't realize that their own soldiers, their own government is repressing another people. And at the same time, it's not only that they're repressing, occupations are usually short-term, and they have a specific purpose. The Israelis have crossed all the red lines. They have no intention of withdrawing from the occupied territories, and that is a violation of international law. International law says occupation has to have clear legal end, has to have a motivation, and has to be short-term. So what the Israelis don't understand is that they cannot live in peace when Palestinians are under repression.
Thanks a lot, Dawood Kotab, joining us from Amman.
You're welcome.
Elsewhere, the death toll from Tropical Storm Megi in the Philippines rises to 58 as rescuers find more bodies. The storm caused flooding and landslides in the central and southern parts of the country. At least 50 of the fatalities were reported in the center and provinces of Leyte and Negros Oriental. Leyte is the hardest hit, where more than two dozen people remain missing. Storm Megi made landfall in the Philippines over the weekend, the strongest hit the archipelago this year. It caused heavy rain and brought winds of up to 65 kilometers per hour. On the east coast alone, Megi forced over 13,000 to evacuate their homes. Authorities in China's commercial hub Shanghai say they will strictly deal with anyone who violates COVID lockdown rules. The city is fighting the biggest COVID outbreak China has seen since the virus was first detected in late 2019. Daily cases have been increasing over the past several weeks, passing 25,000. Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Today, too, I will raise a few points that might not have been raised until now. One point that must be made sooner than the others is that I have heard that the Parliament has allocated a heavy budget to the Jihad of Clarification. I'm not really all right with such ways of treating the matter. It is many years now that I have been in touch with organizations, the budget and other such matters. My experience tells me that such indefinite budgets are usually wasted without any results. If the Parliament allocates a heavy budget to it, it is not correct. Of course, I trust the officials who receive these budgets. I will tell you that I do not distrust them in any way. Whether the officials in the Ministry of Islamic Guidance or the ones in the Islamic Development Organization and the like, I trust them and they are pious and morally healthy. But the allocation of a heavy budget in the name of the Jihad of Clarification is wrong by nature. I hope that the gentlemen in the Parliament pay attention to this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In sum, I do not agree with it. As a person who attaches great significance to the Jihad of Clarification, I do not agree with such budget allocations and such spendings. This is one point. The second point is that in a hard war, one cannot fight with the use of old weapons. Nowadays, one cannot go to battle against cannons and missiles with swords, arrows, and the like. The same is true of the Jihad of Clarification. One cannot work with the old methods. Of course, some old methods are irreplaceable, such as speaking directly to the people and practicing panegyric. These are old methods, but there are no replacement for them. They continue to be influential and nothing can replace them. But in terms of various tools and instruments, we must update ourselves. Of course, our hardware weapons are good in this area. Our cyberspace and other such networks are active and they are working. Although cyberspace has certain problems, by God's favor, Mr. Raisi and his friends must show determination and resolve those problems as soon as possible. It is accessible in any case.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. Things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S., so naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and military equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in Syria for its oil. Additionally, security conditions have been deteriorating in the areas under the control of U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in Syria's northern and northeastern provinces of Raqqa, Hasaka, and Deir ez-Zor.
The Assads, Hafez and Bashar al-Assad, who have been the last two presidents of Syria, have not allowed the United States or the corporations of the West to come into the country and buy up the oil companies and began allowing Shell and British Petroleum and the other major oil monopolies to come into Syria and to steal the natural resources that rightly belong to the Syrian nation, to the Syrian government and their people. And so as a result, the United States has decided, with the backing of NATO and Western European powers, that the only option at this point is either a full invasion of Syria to topple the Assad government, which would be absolutely disastrous and have horrible repercussions for the United States and the West on a geopolitical scale.
Local Syrians complain that U.S.-backed militants' constant raids have generated a state of frustration and instability, severely affecting their businesses and livelihood. Residents accuse the U.S.-sponsored militants of stealing crude oil. Local council affiliated with the militants also stand accused of financial corruption. France's 2022 presidential vote is divided into two rounds, a free-for-all and a runoff vote between the top two contenders. 12 candidates, ranging from the far right to the far left, are running for this election. If a candidate secures over half of the total vote, they will directly win the election, but this hasn't happened since Charles de Gaulle's re-election in 1965. Otherwise, only the top two candidates make it through to the second round, and whoever wins that round will be the new French president for a five-year term. President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to become the first incumbent to win re-election since Jacques Chirac in 2002. He is vowing to continue to decrease taxes, raise the pension age to 65, and get France to full employment after decades of mass joblessness. But Macron entered the race late, and his second term is facing a real threat from far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, as polls show a closing of the gap between the incumbent and his main rival. Le Pen was the runner-up in the 2017 elections. This will be her third attempt at the presidency. She's a key far-right figure and the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded France's National Front and is notorious for his racist, anti-immigrant views. Le Pen has focused on the cost of living crisis, while her anti-immigration program would ban the Muslim headscarf from all public places. Voters have complained of a lack of new political ideas or vision, and few solutions to their problems, including purchasing power and the high cost of living, healthcare, and the fight against climate change. There have been fewer rallies, and voters have complained there was no direct TV debate between all candidates. As a result, an unprecedented number of French voters say they are unsure who to vote for, particularly young and low-income voters. Voter turnout has decreased from 84% in 2007 to about 78% in 2017, and it is believed that abstention may be even higher this time. A low turnout could have a major impact on the vote. France's 2022 presidential election is unlike the previous ones. That's mainly due to the events that have taken place in the political and social scene of France in recent years and intensified the pressure on minorities such as Muslims and immigrants. For Muslims, the election of Emmanuel Macron was supposed to provide relief after 5 years of François Hollande. However, Macron's first term has been gloomy for French Muslims. Many French Muslims no longer see him as the centrist that he claimed to be in 2017, particularly due to the adoption of the separatism law in the summer of 2021. The government claims its legislation is intended to strengthen France's secular system. Critics, however, say it unfairly singles out the Muslim community and restricts religious freedom. France has been criticized by international organizations and NGOs, especially the UN, for targeting and marginalizing Muslims with the law. Since February 2018, France has controlled nearly 25,000 mosques, schools, associations, and workplaces and closed 718 of them, including over 20 mosques.
France, like many other European and Western nations, is going through ever-increasing Islamophobia and environment of hate against Muslims. And the reality is that this environment is escalating by politicians and by media and by the policies of otherization, i.e. targeting Muslims as the reason and the problems for everything whatsoever.
The alleged centrist Macron has no solution for France's anti-Muslim problems. And in case far-right Le Pen replaces him, things are probably not going to change for the better. Therefore, French Muslims have a choice to make: abstention or taking a chance on a left candidate.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
You're suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off the jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation off the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA, and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancée says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of
إنما سمي رمضان
لأنه يرمض الذنوب.
Verily, the month of Ramadan has been thus named because it scorches away sins.
What does Maha Ramadan mean to us?
This is Dialogue, a program on the holy month of Ramadan and the importance of fasting. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program. This is Dialogue. We're talking about the blessed and holy month of Ramadan. The holy month of Ramadan, as you all know, is the blessed and honorable month when the doors of the Almighty Allah's mercy are open. It is the blessed month when forgiveness is easy to gain, but only if we take our steps in this direction. The holy month of Ramadan, the great month when the doors of hell are closed, a beautiful, a blessed, an honorable month, a month where we return towards the Almighty Allah. The holy month of Ramadan, a month where we gain our provisions for our journey towards the hereafter. The holy month of Ramadan, where we establish a connection with our loving, nurturing Lord, our Creator and Sustainer, Allah, exalted and glorified is He. The holy month of Ramadan, the greatest of months, the most honorable of months. This month in which we can return towards Allah. This month in which we can reconnect with Allah. This month in which we can gain the provisions for the hereafter. This, the holy month of Ramadan.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله: إذا استهل رمضان غلقت أبواب النار وفتحت أبواب الجنان وصفدت الشياطين.
Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم stated: As soon as the month of Ramadan sets in, the gates of hell are locked up, the gates of paradise are opened, and the devils are bound up.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio, and we were talking about the holy month of Ramadan. We find, dear friends, in the holy month of Ramadan, this blessed month, this divine month, this month which is full of opportunities, this month in which the Holy Quran was revealed and was sent down, this holy month in which all of the divine books were sent down, according, of course, to a tradition from the Holy Prophet. This month in which we can truly improve our lives, turn over a new leaf, make a permanent, positive spiritual change in our lives. This very beautiful and honorable holy month of Ramadan. Now, of course, we know about the fact that we should not eat or drink while we are fasting in the holy month of Ramadan. This in itself is difficult because we have to be able to control our body, control our desires, control our instincts. It is interesting that the holy month of Ramadan teaches us that truly the mind and the soul
is stronger and more powerful than the physical material body. Now, along with this idea that we should fast from, you know, eating and drinking in the holy month of Ramadan, we also talked about in one of our programs that there are various characteristics that we must avoid, such as lying and sinning and backbiting and oppression and abusing people. And likewise, there are certain characteristics that we need to inculcate and we really need to work on in this holy month of Ramadan, such as paying special attention to prayers and patience and truthfulness and a kind of strong silence. And of course, the constant remembrance of the Almighty Allah. But we find, dear friends, in other narrations from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, and the Ahlul Bayt and the divinely appointed Imams, that they say in the narrations, anyone who does not obey the divine guide in relation to personal and family matters behaves badly and without mercy with their spouse. So again, because this is a list of a few things, the first thing here is that anyone who doesn't obey Allah the Almighty when it comes to their personal and family matters, the fasting of this kind of a person is not accepted. And then they say that another thing which results in the fasting of a person not being accepted is when one behaves badly and unjustly and without mercy towards their spouse. And in order to have our fasting be accepted, we must pay attention to our family matters and to our family relations in this holy month of Ramadan in order to be successful by the will and might of Allah, inshallah. This is Dialogue, the holy month of Ramadan.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of our faith. And all physically fit and mature Muslims are required to fast every day of this month of Ramadan. Fasting is not unique to Islam. It is there in Christianity, in Judaism, even in Hindu and Buddhist tradition. There is this tradition of fasting. However, in Islam, when we talk about fasting, it is more involved in a sense that every day of the month of Ramadan, we have to abstain from dawn to dusk, abstaining from food, even from drinking water. And those who are smokers are not allowed to smoke. At the end of the holy month of Ramadan, we celebrate a very important occasion, which is known as Eid al-Fitr. And this is comparable to Christmas among Christians, for example. And that day is a very major day for us, where all Muslims would gather in their mosques for a special prayer. But in our religious teachings, there is a requirement that before we even go and participate in that special prayers on Eid al-Fitr, the heads of family are required to pay a special charity on that day on behalf of themselves and their family members. That process known as, you know, paying that charity on the day of Eid is just like, you know, after going through the process of fasting for the whole month, it's as if God is now holding our hand, helping us to walk on the path of charity and sharing with others. Then maybe now that you have fasted for this long, you know the feeling of the poor and the needy people. And so this is what you have to start. Hopefully, you will continue the tradition of charity. And so when we look at this tradition, you know, it has personal benefits for us on physical level, on spiritual level, but also it's a community issue. This whole sense of gathering, you know, thanks God, all families could have been sitting in their own homes and having their own iftar without any problem. But this whole spirit of community building, where in the month of Ramadan, Muslims gather in the mosques so that they can be part of the community when they break their fast, known as iftar. And, you know, very soon after the prayers, you'll be able to witness and be part of that very beautiful tradition that we have in the Muslim society.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. محارب اتصال برب العالمين وروضات سناها تقيم الوحي فينا محارب اتصال برب العالمين وروضات سناها
Californian drought. This old farmer hasn't seen this much snow in years.
This is just water that's coming off of the mountain that's held up here because the old thing, thousands and thousands, millions, huge years ago, made it so that this was a solid area, so all the water is held right at this level in this area before it goes clear on hundreds of miles north.
...180 years ago, white farmers displaced the Shoshone tribe. This arid desert was known as Nevada, meaning snow-covered. Dean Baker is 71 years old. For years, he has fought the southern water thieves, as he calls them.
The danger is that I am believed that their old total intention was to take all the water.
We met Dean 7 years ago in his wife Denise's coffee house while reporting on a pipeline project that would transport water to Las Vegas. Back then, he explained that for many years, they had been using the springs of this land for their cattle. He warned that if Las Vegas Water Authority pumped their water table, their springs would dry out.
It's drier now than it was 7 years ago. Last year we had no moisture, we had no snow, and it didn't get cold. This storm we had is the first good storm we've had in about 3 years.
For Dean Baker, keeping water in Snake Valley is his life's work. Dean Baker said that there used to be many springs in this area, but unfortunately, due to the Las Vegas pipeline project, the ecosystem has been disrupted. Pumping the water tables has caused the wells to go dry. Many wild horses have died of thirst just because there are no springs left.
Oh, this is the 100-year war. We're ahead right now. We've won 4 out of 5 court cases, so we're on top. We're waiting to see what they're going to do next.
They thought they could convince me to sell the ranch, and I never would. And so I got to see what they really did, and I learned hugely what they wanted to do. I learned that what they really expected is to get all the ranches, all the land, and they intended to take all of the water, the one running off the mountains, and the water, and just take all the water and do away with all the farms and ranches and just put the water down there and do away with it.
The Bakers breed 2,000 heads of cattle on a 48 square kilometer area. They want authorities to change their policies.
Well, I just thought it would be a disaster, and what it would be, it would, in the end, it would be a way with taking away with the livestock that was on there, all of the things.
Wildlife.
On the wildlife and a lot of things, it would be just a disaster.
Construction was to start in 2008. This giant project would cost $3 million. 20 million cubic meters of water would go to Las Vegas.
We went through the Great Recession when the economy crashed. And, of course, Nevada and Las Vegas were hurt worse than any place in the country. The unemployment rate, the foreclosures on the houses, all of that. It was hard on us. Any business in the United States really had a tough time. And we learned some lessons from it running our business. Las Vegas is back to where it was before the Great Recession, building as fast, spending money the same way they were, and they didn't learn a thing from that recession.
According to the Las Vegas Valley Water District, a Las Vegas resident consumes 446 liters a day. 3 times more than a German. Saving water is only just now being considered.
It's hard to say how long this city in the desert can masquerade as a lush paradise. The manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority had actually sounded the alarm many years ago. A few years later, she said,
"The pipeline project's not dead. It is still very much a part of the resource plan. We knew we were going to be taken to court, but the immediacy of it isn't there. I mean, unless there's a catastrophe on the Colorado River, it won't be needed for 15, 20 years. So we have the luxury of time."
The situation at the Hoover Dam shows how dire things are. Since 1998, water levels at Lake Mead are dropping. This Colorado dam supplies water to Southern California and to farms in Arizona and Nevada.
It's lower than I remember it from last time I was here, about 9 months ago. And it's been low for a while, as you can tell, because there's vegetation almost at the water line. So it's this time of year, the water should be much, much higher, and it's just not enough. There's just not